It's Italy's commercial powerhouse city, and where you can see Da Vinci's masterpiece, The Last Supper. Coming up today on Travel with Rick Steves, we'll hear why Milan is a favorite place for guides from small-town Italy to escape into high culture and fashion. Plus, our favorite tour guide from Bulgaria wants you to know about the neighboring countries he calls the Unknown Balkans. He has suggestions for visiting the Southern Balkans, with their rustic charm as backdoor destinations. If any of your ancestors came from the countries we usually think of as Eastern Europe, I'll bet you'd be surprised by the stories and legends they probably heard growing up. Jacob Mikanowski has researched his own Jewish and Catholic family roots in Poland and Lithuania and became fascinated with uncovering what the lives of the everyday people were like in this volatile region, and how their stories and sense of humor convey a history that's long been crisscrossed by dueling empires and powerful rulers. He's written Goodbye Eastern Europe, an intimate history of a divided land, to stir up the narratives that nations often tell about themselves. Jacob, welcome back to Travel with Rick Steves.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So first of all, how do you define Eastern Europe?
So I kind of have a big tent definition, bigger than a lot of people who live in Eastern Europe. But it's between Germany on one side, Russia on the other, going from about Estonia in the north down to Albania in the south. That whole zone of small countries worried about their independence. And it's also a real cradle of European diversity.
And it's kind of a crossroads, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's a series of intersecting frontiers, religious frontiers, imperial frontiers, sort of a lot of fault lines running all the way through it.
I was just thinking tectonic plates when you said fault lines. It's really like that. And when you think this is where Slavic Europe hits Germanic Europe, this is where Orthodox Europe hits Islam, there's so many tectonic plates coming together. And geologically, you get earthquakes and volcanoes.
Absolutely. Big tensions. And that's been part of the history. That's why it's a divided land. And those divisions are multiple and overlapping.
Now, you wrote that the history you learned in Eastern Europe was written in the big imperial capitals, you know, Vienna, Istanbul, and St. Petersburg, and later in Berlin and Moscow. But now you see it a little bit differently. How do you see it?
So that is, if you read a lot of the history and you go back 200 years ago, back 400 years, most of the region belonged to one of three empires, Ottoman, Austro-Hungarian or Habsburg, and Russian. And you read the history, it'll be written from those points of view. It'll be about the Habsburg emperors. It'll be about Peter the Great and Catherine the Great. You have that story told from those capitals, but wasn't lived there. Mm. If you have Polish roots, you have Slovenian roots, you have Romanian roots, your ancestors lived a life far from the capital and lived in a different society, different world from that world of kings and queens. And kind of this tries to get back to that world of experience on the ground.
Yeah.
So not just the decisions of the big.
And by the way, the emperor probably spoke a language that you didn't
Absolutely.
Understand. You know, you got the emperor in Vienna, he speaks German.
And you see them as a very distant, very remote figure from your life.
And you're saying like the Ottomans and the Romanovs and the Habsburgs and the Hohenzollerns, mm-hmm. the big royal families, 1918, they're all gone.
All gone.
Bam. Talk about fast history. And suddenly that big, vast sweep from Estonia to Albania that you're talking about, it doesn't have that imperial overlord.
It's a bunch of new nation states. Some of them have roots in the older past. Some of them are brand new. They're like Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia. Brand new. Some of them are combinations of weird
Czechoslovakia.
Stuff. Czechoslovakia. Those have never been together. Yugoslavia, which is the land of the South Slavs. Those have never been together, put together.
And in your book, you call it a land of small states and complicated fates.
It is that, you know, you don't get that with French history or Spanish history. Those boundaries are set 1,000 years ago and they kind of shift along the margins, but you don't have the sense of could France disappear one year, could Spain disappear? But these countries kind of come and go. They are independent for a while, they vanish, they come back. Ukrainian history is like that. Almost every story like that is of moments of sovereignty, long periods of being dominated.
And Jacob, when you think about the history, how we learn, who tells the history, most of the history was written from the imperial capital's perspective. But what I like about your book is it tells the history with folklore. Tell us about folklore as a teaching tool for understanding a story of a nation.
I think it's so essential because it gets you under that surface. It gets you away from that story of kings and queens and into the story of regular people. And folklore is really the literature of regular people, the literature of the poor, literature of the illiterate, which is what most people were for most of time. And to get that perspective, though, of the common person, the everyday person, folklore gives that to you. It gives you the mythological world of the different religions, different peoples that make this so rich.
What are the pros and cons of that?
The pros are you get a sense of the imaginative world of the past, of how things appeared, how things were understood. The con is it's not linear narrative history of events and time. It's much more a story of seasons and the story of generations and of little catastrophes and of stuff coming through, yeah.
It's kind of organic.
And it can be a little intangible. Yeah. Because if you have that story from the capital, you have this king, this emperor, and then the next emperor and the reforms. But that story gets written like a soccer match, you know, like Hitler and Stalin will be kicking the soccer ball around between each other, or the emperor versus the sultan. But I'm kind of interested in the ball's perspective, you know?
Yeah.
In Eastern Europe, you feel a lot that history is being done to you.
Jacob Mikanowski examines the culture, politics, religion, and ideologies of Eastern Europe over 2,000 years in his book, Goodbye Eastern Europe, An Intimate History of a Divided Land. You'll find links to his work and his earlier visits with us with this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio.
So if we're thinking about folklore, I'm just trying to think of some examples, and your book is just filled with them. You've got a little chapter on vampires, and you talked about how in Western Europe, there's almost no countries that have a history of vampires, and in Eastern Europe, almost every country has a history of vampires. That's folklore. That's total, you know, that's just total la-la land. But it's part of that weave, the cultural weave.
Mm-hmm. And it goes deep. You know, that's the thing that there's another dimension. You know, paganism lasted longer in Eastern Europe than anywhere else in Europe.
Huh.
There were pagan princes in Lithuania when you already had the Renaissance going on in Italy.
Yeah.
This is the stronghold. And then it got pushed out, but went underground, went into kind of, you know, if you go to the Baltics, they have this real cult of the trees that there was an outdoor religion. And so trees were a huge part of that. And in Lithuania, they have famous oak trees. Like they'll put them on the postage stamps because it's like a famous oak. And they still have this cult of trees. And you can kind of been in Latvia, places where until recently, there are groves that you couldn't go into or you couldn't break any branch because they had that aura around them. And that's that remnants of paganism that's in there.
Yeah. It's like in Estonia, they've got these wonderful graveyards that are forests.
Mm-hmm.
And you're there, you're burying your loved ones and your ancestors with the trees and the spirit of the country. It's nationalism. It's gorgeous. It's really deep. It's powerful.
And that's why I try to get in folklore, because there's an element, there's the official history, and then there's something underneath that people feel very strongly.
What about, you know, Béla Bartók spent his whole career running around Hungary looking for folk tunes,
mm-hmm.
the great composer Béla Bartók. He was dredging that country for its folk music. It must have been something to him.
And he said something really beautiful. He, you know, he would go to Hungary, and Hungary used to be bigger than Hungary. He used to cover a lot of Romania, used to cover most of Slovakia, used to cover a little bit of Serbia. And he said, actually, there is no national folk music. There's no Hungarian melody. There's no Romanian melody. There's no Roman melody. These melodies all just communicate and transform and get picked up from village to village, valley to valley. And you can't isolate any kind of ethnic side. That's folklore. It's that common language of melody in music and mythology and literature.
And speaking of singing, it reminds me of Estonia. Because Estonia, imagine trying to survive a little country of 1 million people who speak Estonian. And Russia's got its sights on you. Russia wants you off the map. And Germany's no friend either. And the Estonians realize we're hopelessly outgunned, but we can sing, so at least mm-hmm. people know we're here. And the Estonians heroically sang, and it helped. You could say it actually helped bring down the Soviet Union.
It absolutely did. It had these singing festival turned into an independence celebration, turned into an independence movement. That's the same idea that
What are they singing about?
The folklore, the trees, the bear pelt.
The ghosts of Estonia in the forest where their loved ones' bodies are going back to the dust.
And they recreated a kind of pagan past for themselves because all that got fragmented and lost. And then in the 19th century, they came up with a version of it that they could celebrate. And that drew on that past, that drew on bits and pieces of local folklore and names and recreated it.
Jacob, to wrap up this conversation about getting beyond conventional history, what's a folk legend or something from your childhood growing up in a Polish family? What's an example for you of a folk legend that has some meaning?
The Black Wedding. It's a Schwarze Kasane. This is a Yiddish idea. And this actually happened in my grandfather's shtetl. He's from a little...
What's a shtetl?
Shtetl literally means little town. These little towns used to dot Poland, Lithuania, Jewish majority towns. Most of the people in them, 50%, 70% would be Jewish. And sometimes they'd have a terrible disease or plague would come in. And if, you know, people would try medicine, they would try doctors, they would try, but they didn't have antibiotics, didn't have real things to call on. And when things are really bad, you had to go back to the thing that most Eastern Europeans go back to, which is the dead. The dead are everywhere, and the dead can harm or they can help. And when things got really bad, and this actually happened in my grandfather's shuttle in 1893, there was a bad outbreak of typhus, 20 people died in one night, and they said, well, we have to have a black wedding. And a black wedding is when you take two people who can't get married otherwise, who are crippled, who are too poor, and you take them, and the town acts as matchmaker, and you say, you and you, you're going to get married. And we're going to give you everything you need. The town gives them everything they need for the wedding. They give them everything they need, all the bridal stuff. And they have the wedding in the cemetery because it's such a happy event. And the dead in the cemetery get to be the guests, to take part in that happiness. And the hope is if they do that, they'll reward the town by getting the plague to go away. And I always thought that was just a pure legend, that this is completely kind of made up. And I was doing research for this book, and there was in my grandfather's shtetl, and the account was actually written by my great-grandfather's uncle. It was something he had seen with his own eyes, a real factual thing. They really did the black wedding. The people involved became kind of known in town. The woman became the town's daughter-in-law, and she was, you know, this poor, poor woman, but she was proud because she had helped stop the plague. You know, I was writing about this during COVID, and I'm like, well, different times, but same concerns, same preoccupations.
In 1893, as you said, not that long ago.
Not that long ago.
Jacob Michanowski, thanks so much for joining us and best wishes with your teaching about Eastern Europe.
Thanks so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Jacob Michanowski writes about solar storms, insect die-offs, and his great-grandfather's role in communist Poland. It's at jacobmikanowski.com, spelled M-I-K-A-Nowski. We'll get tips for enjoying Italy's capital of finance, fashion, and design in just a bit. But first, let's head south to the Balkans for three countries you probably never think about. That's next on Travel with Rick Steves.